try to provide for your kids and your wife. When you get too old to produce anymore, they hand you your hat and they show you the door. And you're too old to work, too old to work. When you're too old to work, you're too young to die. Who will take care of you while you get by? When you're too old to work and you're too young to die. You don't ask for favors when your life is through. You've got a right to what's coming to you. Your boss gets a pension when he is too old. You helped him retire, you're out in the cold. And you're too old to work, too old to work. When you're too old to work and you're too young to die. Who will take care of you, how you get by? When you're too old to work and you're too young to die. They put horses to pasture. They feed them on hay. Even machines get...
And this is The World of Work, and I'm your host, Shep Cohen. What was your favorite cereal as a kid? Cheerios or Frosted Flakes? Wheaties or Cocoa Puffs? Chances are, if you're still eating cereal, you're not eating the sweet cereal now that you ate when you were a kid. But cereal is probably still a part of your daily or weekly routine. Americans love their breakfast cereal, which is second only to milk and soda in supermarket spending. It's the quintessentially American invention. In fact, granola first came upon the scene in the early 1860s. Our guest today, Topher Ellis, is the co-author of The Great American Cereal Book, which is the definitive compendium of breakfast cereal history and lore. It celebrates the most recognizable brands and packaging, and they are some of the most enduring pop culture icons of the 20th century. Topher Ellis and co-author Marty Gitlin provide behind-the-scenes story about the creations of these iconic kitchen table favorites. I'm happy to welcome Topher Ellis to The World of Work. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for being on The World of Work this afternoon.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
It's great to be with you. And what you got you interested in breakfast cereal and the lore of breakfast cereal?
Growing up in the early 60s with two brothers, I enjoyed competing for the prize in the bottom of the cereal box. As I got older and I had children and my son got into the cereal eating age, I began collecting characters and history for my breakfast cereal character guide website back in 1987.
And gradually, not only were you interested in cereals, but you became probably the preeminent expert in breakfast cereal in the country. How did you make the transition from someone who had an interest and liked to eat breakfast cereal to someone who has become an expert in breakfast cereal?
Well, years of collecting and reporting on cereal characters, history and marketing, years of talking with cereal insiders and collectors, years of studying the cereal aisle and working with marketers. It's been a lot of fun.
And you actually have a newsletter on breakfast cereal called The Box Top. What about that?
Well, that's a seasonal newsletter that's published on the Internet whenever I have enough good content.
And who does it go out to? Who's interested? Who's your audience for your newsletter?
Well, everyone that enjoys cereal, humor, and cereal-related items like prizes, bowls, characters, coupons, marketing, sales. I've been doing that since about 1999.
And you mentioned the prizes that you find in cereal boxes. When did they start as a marketing ploy, I guess, the prizes?
Well, one of the first cereal premiums might have been the Funny Jungle Land moving picture booklet that shoppers were able to buy with two boxes of cornflakes. Kellogg's offered that back in about 1909.
And ever since, there have been one type of prize after another.
There have been. We went through the 50s, 60s, had a lot of good prizes, 70s as well. As we worked our way into the 80s, 90s, it was tough to find a prize, at least what I would call a good cereal-related toy. We did get into the 80s and early 90s where you might be able to mail away or get something totally unrelated to the cereal, something like a tie-in or a promotion of some sort that was unrelated. I think the best prizes that came out were the ones that were character-oriented, and that literally came in the box themselves.
And how about the box top? That has played a major role over the years. You could always, I remember growing up when they'd say, if you want to buy something, rip off so many box tops of cereals. And there was even a group of the box tops, I think they in the 60s. Tell us about the box top and the significance of the box top and cereals, breakfast cereals.
Well, as a way to make folks buy multiple boxes of cereal or multiple brands of cereal, you could collect several box tops, fill out a form, mail it in, and get all sorts of even better prizes than they could actually stick in the box itself.
And ultimately, you've moved from someone who ate cereal to someone who has an interest in cereal to someone who wrote and still writes a newsletter to an author of the ultimate book on breakfast cereal. What made you move to that direction to write a book about cereal?
Well, it was a natural extension of my website.
And what came next? I know that you wrote your book, which actually just recently came out, with Marty Gitlin. How did you hook up with him? Was he someone who had any expertise in cereal, or does he have expertise in writing?
Actually, he's got the expertise in writing. He's a sports writer out of Cleveland, and frankly, it was his idea. He sought me out, and we immediately went to work.
Really? He sought you out?
He did.
Through your website?
Correct.
And do you live in Cleveland area also, or?
No, I'm in Charlotte.
Ah. How do you divvy up the responsibilities for writing a book when he's in Cleveland, you're in Charlotte, the two of you are, one is a writer, one is an expert in cereal. How do you decide who's going to do what when you're writing a book like that?
Well, Marty came up with a general format for presenting the information on each cereal, which I think was just brilliant. It makes it almost dictionary or encyclopedia usage. And he also wrote most of the articles. I was responsible for the information in the articles, the bulk of the information in the book, and, of course, the research behind it, as I had a good 10-year head start on him on that area. We both worked to fill in the holes, and Marty also secured the photography.
And when you say secured the photography, the book is just filled with wonderfully colored pictures of cereal boxes and all kinds of trivia. Is that something that's in your collection, or where did you get these pictures from, or did you get them on the internet? Tell us a little bit about that.
Wow, I wish I had those in my collection. No, Marty got a hold of some great photographers, specifically Rob Ritzenthaler, Don Chick, and they physically went to collectors in Minnesota, Michigan, and New Hampshire, and these collectors were just really nice. They opened up their homes and allowed them to take all these beautiful pictures of these pristine boxes and cereal characters, and we've got, oh, gee whiz, about 350 of these beautiful pictures throughout the book. It's just, I think it's one of the good things about the book.
How long did it take you to put the book together?
Well, if you include my 10-year head start, it was about 15 years. But relative to the time that Marty came to me, it was about 6 years from start to finish. We were updating the project all the way up to our printing date late last year.
And how did you, like, for example, you had the pictures taken. How did you find out who these collectors were, and how did you find the photographers to take the pictures?
Marty found the photographers. I don't know what he used to get them, but I think he did a great job in finding them. Relative to the collectors, if you go online, there's some websites and things like that display some of that. They're just interested folks that are very happy to share.
When Marty Gitlin came to you, Topher Ellis, and said he wanted to write a book with you about cereal, did you think he was legitimate? Did you think he was pulling your leg? What was your initial reaction?
My initial reaction was, all right, let's do it. I mean, it had been something that I kind of had in the back of my head that I want to do. I never took the next step to actually work towards making it happen. So when he said, hey, I want to do this, it was like, all right, great, let's do it. And he got, he got it rolling.
Did he have the publisher lined up, or did you have to go out and get a publisher?
No, we got an agent, and we shopped it around, and eventually we came around to Abrams, which I think we couldn't be happier with, because they do a very nice book, and they're known for putting out books with just gorgeous, gorgeous pictures, and that was a major focus of the book, and I think Abrams has done a brilliant job.
And not only are they brilliant pictures, but they're so colorful, and I understand in publishing now that many publishers are reluctant to spend the money because it's much more expensive to publish a book which is colorful than one that's black and white.
True. Abrams took a look at what we had and what we had proposed and the beautiful boxes and things, and he knew we had something good here. So they took the risk and ran with it.
Describe the cover of your book, which is really consistent with the beauty of the interior of the book, and it's very unique.
Yes, I'd say it's beautiful. It's bright yellow and it's designed to look like a cereal box. The front's got a bowl of cereal with a spoon, you know, just like you normally see on a cereal box. The spine has nutritional facts about the book. It's fun.
And who was it that actually designed that cover?
That would be Jeff Speer and Neil Egan. They both work for Abrams Books.
And if someone is interested in getting a copy of your book, The Great American Cereal Book, how would they go about getting it?
Well, it's available at your favorite bookstore, some specialty retailers. You can find it online. You can also grab a copy of the book via a link from my website.
And your website is?
Well, either Lava Surfer, LavaSurfer.com, or if you just look up Topher's Breakfast Cereal Character Guide, Google will take you right there.
Who do you anticipate being the audience for your book?
Well, generally anybody that really enjoys cereal consumers, industry insiders, trivia lovers, and baby boomers who enjoyed some of the great characters of the 60s and 70s. It's a nice piece of pop culture and a chance to relive some great memories.
I mentioned my opening that aside from milk, cereal is about the biggest selling item in a supermarket. Milk and soda are the only items that really will surpass it. Is that accurate?
I believe that's accurate. It's extremely big business.
And how many different companies are there that produce in the market today that produce cereal?
Well, there are six big ones. You've got General Mills, Kellogg's, Quaker Oats, Ralston, which nowadays does most of your generics, most of the store brands. There was Nabisco, which is now owned by Post, and of course Post.
Tell us a little bit about Battle Creek, Michigan. That's a famous place in the history of cereal.
Yes, that would be John Harvey Kellogg's place of business. Basically, Dr. John Kellogg ran the Battle Creek Sanitarium up in Michigan. His first official cereal was made of wheat flour, cornmeal, and oatmeal baked into a biscuit, which was then broken up. He named it Granula, which coincidentally was the name of a cereal that Dr. James Caleb Jackson had come up with earlier. Caleb sued, and Kellogg had to change the name to Granola, so that's where we get Granola. John's brother, Will Keith Kellogg, which you now know if you take a look at most Kellogg cereal boxes, W.K. Kellogg, that's his brother, was working in the sanitarium's experimental kitchen when he accidentally left a pot of boiling wheat on the stove overnight. That gooey concoction that resulted made for a crispy wheat flake when rolled flat and baked. This cereal was called Granos, and that became the first flake cereal. 4 years later, in about 1898, the Kellogg brothers created a good cornflake formula, but it still took them another 4 years to perfect a more flavorful and stable cornflake, which was the genesis of Kellogg's cornflakes you can buy today.
And how about the granula? Was that actually something that you could just take and put milk on top of it and eat?
Basically, that was a mixture of graham flour and water that was baked into bricks. Those bricks were then broken up and baked again. And no, you really had to soak it overnight in milk just to make it edible.
So what you're saying is that it was almost by accident that our first breakfast cereal was invented?
Absolutely.
Hmm. And Battle Creek, Michigan, you always hear about that. I guess in the advertisements, they'd always say, Kellogg's from Battle Creek, Michigan. Is Battle Creek, Michigan still where Kellogg's products are produced?
Kellogg's is still in Battle Creek. And of course, the reason Battle Creek and Michigan became so synonymous with cereal is because with Kellogg building cereal there, that's where a lot of the imitators came out of, and a lot of folks set up shop, you know, in and around the Battle Creek area to produce their cereals in the early 1900s.
And you make a point in your book of emphasizing that cereal, breakfast cereal, is a quintessential American invention. You've mentioned how it started, but why is it that cereal is so American as opposed to being something from other parts of the world?
Well, porridge has been around since antiquity, but it wasn't until folks were experimenting with different grains in the U.S. that what we know as breakfast cereal came into being.
And once it came into being, was there kind of an incubation period? You mentioned some of the developments, the cornflakes that developed shortly after the granola. Did it take off pretty quickly?
Oh, it took off like a flame. The once the flight was developed, folks started, say, hey, this is good. We can make money off of it. It started, as I say earlier, there were over 100 different cornflake varieties that all of a sudden just popped up to try to take advantage of that success.
And besides that, then you had grape nuts, shredded wheat. Did they come up simultaneously with these 100 different varieties of cornflakes?
Well, actually, they came up maybe a tad earlier. In the late 1880s, grape nuts into the 1900s, shredded wheat, granose, granula, granola, and the first cornflakes were developed. It was after that that the other competing flakes just flooded the market.
Now, in those earlier days that you're mentioning, we didn't have pasteurized milk. So was it as quick a cereal, a meal as it is today? Or tell us a little bit about that, the type of milk that was put on.
I never thought about that. I can't tell you too much about that.
Okay. I feel good asking you. I just thought of that now, asking you a question that the expert never thought about.
I'm going to make a note of that.
Okay. How about wheat germ flakes? When did they come out?
That was created around 1910. That was another Kellogg design flake from the Battle Creek Food Company. But other than that, I can't tell you much more about it.
And how about cornflake clones? Did we have a lot of them over the years?
Well, some of the real early ones, like I say, there were about 100 of them. And they came out with names such as Eggosea, Jack Horner Flakes, Krebs Breakfast Flakes Corn, Squirrel Brand, Strength Owen White Bear. One of the real early ones that actually was very successful, though, was one developed by C.W. Post. He developed his in 1904, and he named it Elijah's Manna. 4 years later, though, under pressure from religious fundamentalists, he rechristened it as Post Corn Toasties.
Hmm. Now, being such an expert in breakfast cereal as you are, you've mentioned at the outset that you have a newsletter that comes out regularly. You've written the book on breakfast cereal. Is there anything other than finding out a little bit about the milk that was used? Is there anything else for you to learn?
Yes, I'm always finding new things about characters, about the folk, the talent behind the marketing and the cereals themselves, the production methods. There's lots for me to learn yet.
The production of cereal, how has that developed over the years to make it, so cereal now is the third most popular item in the supermarket?
Well, we went from basically a very healthy cereal thought process to one where later, in much later years, we've got sweetened cereals, and now, of course, we see both on the shelves. But during that whole, 100-plus years that they've been around, we've seen a lot of developments in extrusion processes, dyes, flavors, puffing of cereals, different things like that that has really brought the cereal along, and the new innovations keep it exciting for folks to keep trying.
When did cereals first appear in boxes as they are now?
The 1800s.
Okay. And the boxes that they appeared in, when did they start getting as colorful as they are today?
Well, full color photography and that type of thing came into being in the late 50s that we had any of the better boxes.
And how about, you see on boxes of cereals, nutritional value and their government regulations on keeping them fresh and things of that nature. When did that start, and how did that affect the breakfast cereal business?
Relative to nutrition, that's been a more recent thing. That I think that came out of the 1960s, where Congress was basically getting all over the cereal companies relative to their pricing sugary cereals towards kids and different TV programs and cartoons, and actually having the cartoons themselves stop and say, hey, buy my cereal. There was that, and into the 70s was basically a big nutrition revolution, and you're still seeing it today. I mean, I think every time they change the pyramid or whatever shape they've got currently, they tend to focus on more nutritional type things, and I think that's good as it continues to evolve.
Topher Ellis, do you work when you're not doing your work with cereals, is your profession anything related to cereals?
Not related at all, no.
Okay, so this is just an interest that you have.
Yes, it is.
What do your friends and family think about with your interest, or I'll call it an obsession with the cereal?
Well, they enjoy it. It's relative to the family. We've got probably 36 different boxes of cereal in the house now, and so we got there's a good variety for breakfast. And relative to the Friends, they kind of enjoy some of the quirks where if there's some particular children's cereal, because I don't have any kids in the house anymore, I'll have Friends test them and try them and have them write some reviews for me. And then we give them credit for it in the box top. It's no different than any other hobby, I think.
But you have 36 different cereal boxes in your house. I think that's more than most people would.
Well, I guess it's more fair to say I've got probably 12 different cereals, but I've got about 36 boxes. I buy my favorites when they go on sale, and then I buy about every new cereal that comes out so we can give them a try.
And what are some of your favorites?
Oh, okay. Well, currently it would be like Ralston, Multigrain, Chex. I like the Cascadia Farms Honey Notes Granola, the Post Great Grains, Post Grape Nuts, and the Kashi Autumn Wheat, which I think is one of the better shredded wheat cereals that are out there.
Your recitation of your favorites seem to be healthy foods. Has it always been that way for you, healthy cereals, or were you stuck with the sugary cereals of the 50s and 60s?
I wouldn't say stuck. I thoroughly enjoyed Quisp and Quake as a kid. I liked Freakies. So as a kid, I just absolutely loved those types of cereals, just like anyone else did. And then I do find that I enjoy the less sugary cereals now.
You haven't mentioned Sugar Frosted Flakes. Did you like them, or have you liked them in the past?
For some reason, I never became a fan of the Frosted Flake.
Too sweet for you?
It was. I have to say, at this point in time, Marty's probably rolling over in his seat right now because he loves the sugary type cereals. He just, Jets was his favorite, and he tends to have the sweeter cereals in his house.
I know my wife, to this day, loves Sugar Frosted Flakes, and she can just sit and eat them as a snack without milk. I mean, just like a candy almost.
Yeah, a lot of people do. They'll eat cereal straight out of the box.
Topher Ellis, we have to take a break now. We're speaking this afternoon with Topher Ellis, who is the co-author of the Great American Cereal Book. He's co-author with Marty Gitlin, and it's a behind-the-scenes account of the creation of the iconic kitchen table favorites. Has wonderfully colorful pictures in it and a really great cover. And we'll be back in a few minutes. This is The World of Work. I'm your host, Shep Cohen. And we'll be talking a little bit more about all different aspects of cereal, breakfast cereal, which is an American invention. Topher Ellis, stick with us, and we'll be back with you in about 2 or 3 minutes.
Thank you.
A peanut sat on a railroad track, and his heart was all a flutter. Along came the choo-choo train.
Peanut butter.
You're listening to WDVR-FM, 89.7 in Delaware Township and 91.9 in Lawrenceville, Princeton, Trenton, New Jersey.
And we're back on the air. This is The World of Work, and I'm your host, Shep Cohen. And we're speaking this afternoon with Topher Ellis, who is the co-author of the Great American Cereal Book with Marty Gitlin, and it is the definitive compendium of breakfast cereal history and lore. Topher Ellis, you mentioned that you will purchase and try new cereals when they come out. You've now written, as we've been talking for the last half hour, an amazing book on cereals. You have a newsletter. Do cereal companies know that you're out there and try to please you in any way?
Well, they haven't yet. No, I don't. It's not like they send me a couple boxes of cereal a week or something, although they're more than welcome to if you're out there.
Okay. So any of them are listening, they can send you some cereal boxes.
Absolutely.
Okay. But it's interesting. They don't reach out for you and ask you to sample them.
No, they have not. Maybe it's because they know I'm already buying them when they come out anyway.
When a new cereal comes out, do you then review it in your newsletter?
I do. I don't review every one of them, but there'll be anywhere between 3 and 7 that we'll review in each newsletter. And there, occasionally it'll be one of the older ones I haven't done before, or typically a lot of the newer ones.
What are your criteria for determining whether you would recommend a cereal to someone?
Oh, a lot of it has to do with taste, and within taste you're looking at tactile and how the flavors go, how quickly it gets soggy in milk, how bad the milk tastes after, because I drink the milk after I'm done. There's a lot of factors that go into it. It doesn't hurt to have a gorgeous box. I mean, I've given double ratings for, hey, the cereal's worth this, but the box was gorgeous. So I let folks know that, you know, even if you don't like the cereal, the box is worth keeping.
Is your newsletter interactive? In other words, do those who read the newsletter have the ability to respond and tell you that cereal that you recommended was wonderful, or you're nuts, that cereal was terrible? How can you recommend it?
Yep. It's not set up as a blog where folks can actually write in on there, but I do get comments all the time from folks, and I've got a separate page where I post some comments, and especially I'm always asking for folks to send in their ideas for what they want to see in a new cereal. So basically we're giving the cereal companies free rein at these ideas, which we'd all like to see happen.
How much time do you actually spend on your newsletter each week, month, whatever?
It's purely a weekend project.
Okay. Aside from you eating the new cereals, you know, you buy them, so do others in your family over the years, have they eaten them and gotten their feedback as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Depending on the type of cereal, I'll either eat them and enjoy them and write it up, or I'll ask my daughter to do the same, or I've asked folks in the office or other friends to rate them for me.
Getting back to the history of cereal, which you recount in your book, you mentioned that the period from 1916 to 1948 was a period of cereal stagnation. What do you mean by that, and why was it so?
Well, during that period of time, that's a 32-year span, that there were very few new cereals introduced. But of those new cereals, there were a few superstars. Among the best known in that period were Kellogg's gave us three of them, which were All Bran in 1916, Rice Krispies in 1928, and Raisin Bran in 1942. Coincidentally or not so coincidentally, Post also came out with their Raisin Bran in 1942. General Mills gave us Wheaties in 1922, Kix in 1937, Cheerios in 1941, and Ralston gave us Chex in 1935.
Those are some impressive cereals in cereal history. I've eaten Cheerios my entire life. I guess when I was a baby, and babies still eat Cheerios, and I still have it most weekday mornings for breakfast. What's so special about Cheerios that has kept it on the shelves of the supermarkets continually since 1941?
Well, it's a good-tasting cereal. It's relatively nutritious. They've done a good job of adding some essential vitamins and minerals. It's low in fat. It's made with at least 8 grams of whole grains per serving. As they say, it's a part of a complete breakfast.
Rice Krispies, Snap, Crackle, and Pop. How did they come up with that amazing slogan and make it to Snap, Crackle, and Pop?
Rice Krispies themselves are made of rice grains that are cooked, dried, and toasted. The Snap, Crackle, and Pop sounds come naturally when the cereal is moistened in milk. It became the first talking cereal.
And even to this day, it's still a cereal that attracts kids, and it's still a talking cereal.
Yes, it is.
And an offshoot of that, you have a nice history of this in your book, are Rice Krispie Treats. Tell us about them.
Ah, okay. Well, everyone knows the Rice Krispie Treat. They were created by Mildred Day and Matilda Jensen. These were two ladies that worked for Kellogg's in the late 1930s. It took them about 2 weeks to create a recipe which contains just three ingredients: marshmallows, butter, and Rice Krispies. That recipe has stayed the same to this date. Of course, people have added different add-ins to that, but that's essentially it.
And it's endured ever since. Rice Krispie Treats, I don't know anyone who, even if you don't like Rice Krispies cereal, you like Rice Krispies Treats.
You certainly know what they are.
And I guess along those lines, there was a period that you mentioned in your book when marshmallow cereals or cereals that had a lot of marshmallow in them became pretty prevalent. Tell us about that.
Yes. John Holohan, a General Mills vice president, invented Marbits. These are what we term as cereal marshmallows, but there's something a lot more special than that. Marbits are specially created marshmallows that don't release moisture. If you throw a bunch of regular marshmallows into a box of cereal, you're going to have a messy box of cereal. So this was quite an achievement to be able to come up with something that will actually stay fresh and not give out moisture within the cereal box itself. Lucky Charms was the first cereal to feature the Marbits, and this was in 1964. Over the next 22 years, General Mills was the only company to produce cereals with Marbits, and they brought out about a dozen cereals during that time.
Big sellers, I guess.
Some were, some weren't.
How about, you mentioned a few minutes ago that 1922 Wheaties comes on the scene. When did Wheaties become the breakfast of champions?
Well, Wheaties became associated with sports back in 1927 with an advertisement on a wall at a minor league stadium ballpark that where the Minneapolis Millers played. General Mills used the billboard to run slogans for Wheaties. An advertising man by the name of Knox Reeves is credited with creating the slogan, Wheaties, the Breakfast of Champions, which one day appeared on that wall there back in 1933.
Yeah, in your book you have a few pages with different faces on Wheaties boxes. How is it that they were able to then lure sports champions to have their pictures on the front cover of Wheaties?
Well, at the time, you could get endorsements for sports folks, and a lot of them would do tobacco or other types of advertisements. And Lou Gehrig, for example, was very happy to appear on boxes of Wheaties, and so he became the first back in 1934.
Now, after the period that you mentioned, 1916 to 1948, where you had so few, relatively speaking, new cereals, then you had really a proliferation of cereals. And you go into the 50s, the television age. What did that do to cereals and the marketing of cereals?
Oh, the television age just helped profits explode. All the major cereal manufacturers, led by Kellogg's, sponsored children's programming with the express purpose of selling cereal. They sponsored a number of live shows in the 50s, especially westerns and space shows, and moved towards cartoons and sitcoms in the 60s.
And the cereals that they were marketing were not particularly nutritious and healthy, were they?
No, these were the sugary cereals that kids were really enjoying.
And some of the shows that were sponsored, you mentioned The Lone Ranger, Space Patrol, Howdy Doody, a lot of the kids shows during that time. How did the marketing to the kids in the television age, what effect did that have on sales?
They exploded. Profits were huge. TV was something special. And if your favorite character, if your hero was saying, hey, you got to go buy Kellogg's Pep, then for Pete's sakes, Mom, you got to go buy Kellogg's Pep.
And no one seemed to care that they weren't nutritious anymore.
Well, there were a few people out there that were very vocal against it, but keep in mind too that during the 40s, 50s, cereals were pretty bland, and so folks were literally spooning sugar onto their cereals. I bet that's not uncommon today with some of the healthier cereals. In the early, early 30s, one fellow got the idea of actually making a sweetened cereal. Took the cereal companies a little while later to catch on, but once they started doing it, it sold like wildfire. So basically you're selling a sweetened cereal, but yeah, we're all saying, hey, that's not nutritious, but it's what people wanted and it's what people bought. And I guess what Congress got most upset about is that they were selling it to the kids who were very impressionable.
How come television had such an effect on sales, but the period that you said there was stagnation, 1916 to 1948, that was the radio era, and the radio era didn't really make a dent in sales like the television era did.
During that later end of that era, they did, for example, from 48 to, say, 1949 to 69, they came out with Frosted Flakes, Trix, Special K, Life, Total, Cocoa Puffs, Cocoa Krispies, Smacks, Golden Crisp, Corn Pops. It really got down to taste, marketing, and management. You had to have them all, and you had to be dedicated to keeping the cereal going.
Why is the Trix rabbit smiling?
Well, like my dog, he's got a great disposition, a short memory, a primary need to eat, and he's eternally optimistic.
That's it, huh?
That's it.
You mentioned this a little bit, some of the great animated cereal characters that came along over the years. Can you mention some of them and some of their history?
Well, some of my favorites would include Quisp and Quake, Baron Von Redberry and Sir Greatfellow, Sugar Bear, Trix Rabbit, Lucky the Leprechaun. I mean, it goes on. There's just, boy, there's hundreds of great characters, and that's really a lot of the fun of the whole serial. Get into the serial is all the characters that are out there.
How about, you mentioned the whole pre-sweetened era. You mentioned the various characters. We talk about marshmallows and cereals, all these, all these foods that are not particularly healthy for you. But then we come full circle from granola to granola in the around the late 70s, early 80s period. What happened then? Did we go back to nature?
Yeah, we pretty much did. It was a slow process, though. After, you know, basically indulging in pre-sweetened cereals for two decades, baby boomers were moving into their 20s. They gaining awareness and questioning authority. America was awakening towards a more health-conscious nation. They were assessing everything from air and water pollution to unhealthy foods. And cereal basically still had the attention of Congress. So in the early 70s, healthier cereals like granolas became more successful and grape nut sales took off after featuring naturalist Yule Gibbons. Folks may remember him. Yule was a proponent of natural diets.
Have the cereal companies recognized that there's a niche for healthy cereal and that they're profitable?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, grape nuts and all bran that have been around for over 100 years let you know that, you know, they will survive through generations. However, you know, they kind of went kicking and screaming back into giving us more nutritious cereals because the sweetened cereals were so profitable for them.
Is the Great American Cereal Book about cold cereals that you throw milk on or pour milk on, or does it include hot cereals as well?
We concentrated on the cold cereals.
Okay. Do you have an interest in the hot cereals also, or is that something, is that your next book?
That may be included in the next book.
Okay. We don't have a whole lot of time left, but one of the items that we haven't talked about is the period, the early 80s through the current period, which in your book you have a chapter which you call Make a Toy, Make a Movie, Make a Cereal. Tell us how this has transformed the cereal business.
Oh, okay. Well, in 1981, General Mills became the first company to partner with toy makers, launching Strawberry Shortcake, Orange Blossom, Blueberry Muffin cereals, which were based on their doll counterparts. In 1984, Ralston came out with the first tie-in to a movie, which was Gremlin cereal. General Mills responded with E.T., and Kellogg's jumped in with C-3POs. We've seen dozens of cereals based on toys, movies, computer games, board games, and, you know, basically the years that have followed up to the present. And it certainly changed the way our cereals have looked. And basically, I think the cereal by design basically mirrored America's shorter attention span.
And in mirroring America's shorter attention span, a lot of these cereals have short shelf lives, right?
Well, not because they expire early, but
Of that, but because of the lack of interest in them. They're attached and associated with a movie.
Yes.
Or a toy.
Exactly. Many are tied directly to promotions these days, and they're intended to be short runs. Take a movie like Pirates of the Caribbean or Shrek. Each had a cereal or two which were issued in connection with the release of the movie. When the movie played out, so did the cereal.
Are we stuck with these short-lived cereals that are associated with movies and toys for the foreseeable future?
As long as they continue to be profitable, absolutely.
And are they profitable?
They are, or they want to keep doing it.
Okay. Who's the audience for these? Is this kids, teenagers, adults?
Kids certainly are an attraction to anything with marshmallows in it. So if you put Johnny Depp on the box, maybe you've got a few other audiences. You've got cereal collectors that actually collect the different boxes, and the cooler the box, the more apt you are just to buy the box, regardless of what the cereal tastes like. So you've got a number of different folks that will be looking to try the new cereals, and certainly if there's a favorite movie, great. Let's go get the cereals, see what that's like.
You've mentioned some cereals that have lasted for years. Let's talk about, you know, what you consider some of the superstars of the cold breakfast cereal business.
Oh, thank you. That's fun. I really think there's two categories of superstars. You've got those that are still around and those which we wish were still around. The old-timers include many of the ones we've talked about, but, you know, Grape Nuts, Corn Flakes, Raisin Bran, Cheerios, Frosted Flakes, Captain Crunch, Shredded Wheat, Rice Krispies, Wheaties, Chex, Trix, and Life. The cereals which America would like to see produced again would include, like, Quake, Team Flakes, Jets, Fruit Brute, Baron Von Redberry, Freakies, Vanilla Crunch, and Team Cheerios. I get requests for these all the time. It's like, hey, I can't find this. Well, it's because it's not being made. And it drives people nuts because these are cereals we loved growing up. We want to find them again. And I tell you, if they produced these, they'd be bought.
Kellogg's and General Mills, still prospering independent companies, or are they associated with other companies?
Yes. Both of these companies are and have always been independent. As of last week, Post is once again an independent company. They were just spun off from Ralston, and Quaker Oats is owned by PepsiCo.
It's interesting. I grew up eating Kellogg's products, General Mills products, Cheerios, and With so much consolidation, the fact that the major cereal companies have stayed independent over the years, what do you attribute that to?
Being profitable, growing big, good management. I think all those are important. And the better the management, the more focused they are on protecting a particular brand, and that's what's kept the longevity of some of the brands.
Topher Ellis, we have to close in about 10 or 15 seconds. Any closing thoughts? And Topher Ellis is the co-author with Marty Gitlin of the Great American Cereal Book. I recommend highly that any of you who have ever eaten cereal get a copy of it. Topher Ellis, closing thoughts in the last few seconds.
Thank you. One of my goals of my website and the book is to celebrate the contributions of all the advertising and marketing folks, the artists, the inventors, and the other cereal talent that brought us all of our favorite cereals and characters. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's been a really special interview for me. I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
Until next week, this is The World of Work, and I'm your host, Shep Cohen, and we've just been speaking with Topher Ellis, the author of The Great American Cereal Book.